Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the People Stack. My guest for this episode is Kay Rhodes, software engineering manager at Wondoor. Welcome, Kay.
Hello.
How you doing?
Doing all right.
All right, so let's get things started right away. What does a software engineering manager at Wondoor do? What is your day like?
Most of us are more tech leads than actually managers because we kind of have pretty easy people. So mostly my day, which is probably a little different than the others, my day is answering questions on Slack all day long. And no small part for our contractors in Uruguay because they don't know much about the app and I do. So I just answer questions all day, almost all the time.
Okay. Do you do any coding? So you say it's more technical than manager.
Almost none.
Okay. So even though it's not a really full-blown manager position, you don't do much coding. It's more...
I would love to, but I simply don't have the time.
Okay.
I have some tasks, like every now and then I'll get a little bit of code done. I'm like, I got something done. And, you know, I've got some longer things that my boss has said, like, hey, we could make this happen. And so, you know, what would take, if I assigned it to someone else, a couple days, you know, it takes me a few months because it's just little pieces of time in the background.
Got it. So you're mostly answering questions about that your team has about the code or about like pull requests or like it's okay to go and put this into production kind of thing?
I don't deal with the projects I'm on aren't generally going directly into I'm helping out with the support team now, so I actually am doing that more. And I used to be in charge of the support team, but most of the time it's how does this work? What's the right approach to this? I've got two different solutions. Which one should I use? And sometimes it's just somebody needs to make a call on this. And so I do my best at guessing the appropriate call for the business needs. And yeah.
Got it. And you have a programming background, right?
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit of the story of how you ended up where you are right now?
I went to Berklee School of Music for a year. And then I dropped out and started a graphic design company, because I'd grown up in art studios. And then that morphed into web design. And then I wanted my web pages to do something. So I started programming them for people. But I had started programming probably when I was like 7, when my mom got me a stack of how to program basic books. And I had a Texas Instruments TI-99-4A. And I taught myself to program, made pretty shapes on the screen. And then when I started doing it for websites, I taught myself Perl. And since then, I've learned or touched Perl, PHP, Java, Ruby, Python, Common Lisp, Scheme, Crystal, probably some other stuff.
Okay. And so then you started working for Wondoor, formerly RBM, now Wondoor, as you started working for them as an engineer?
Well, so I started doing the web design programming for my customer sites, like freelance web design stuff. And then I decided that I really hated explaining things to customers. This was back when everybody was on dial-up. And this guy wanted some video on his page because there were some postage stamp sized videos, you know, on pages back then. And I was like, I can technically do that, but you really, really don't want to. It's a terrible idea because it will literally take half an hour for anyone to download this and they're not going to want to. And I gave him all these good reasons why you don't want to put video on your web page back then.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, you're right. And it's really good. And literally the next day he said, so can we put the video on the web page? And like, I couldn't deal. So I started doing, letting headhunters find jobs for me for freelance jobs. And then I would mostly go in and fix other people's broken stuff frequently that they had outsourced to foreign countries and then said, oh my God, this pile of spaghetti, help, help. Mm-hmm. And I would fix that. And then eventually I don't remember what my first, full-time position was. That might've been Akamai. And then I burnt out, traveled the Americas, like North America, Central, South America, and then was totally broke when we got back and started job hunting, found RBM, and they seemed decent. So I said yes, because I couldn't cover rent really. And okay. Yeah.
Okay. And that's quite the career arc already. And you're fairly young guy. Like, I mean, so you're not 70. Let's just say that. That sounds
42.
Like, yeah. Okay. So you've already had almost a whole lifetime of experience between you. So you started at Berkeley, and then you went, and then you sort of pivoted and shifted a whole bunch of different places and a lot of different experiences. And now you're where you are. So do you look back on that thinking, oh wow, I've had so many different experiences, and like, how is that sort of fed where you are now? Is there like a commonality? Is there like a, oh, this is why it happened this way, and I'm really glad it happened this way? Or do you look back at it sort of like, oh, you know, I was just sort of doing what I was doing until I didn't like doing it anymore, and just sort of moved forward from that?
Yeah, that was basically it. Okay. I try and do things that I enjoy until I cease enjoying them, and I try something else that I hope I will enjoy. And if it works out, I continue doing that. And if it doesn't, I try something else that I hope I will enjoy, and okay. repeat until I, yeah, just keep going on like that.
Got it. So looking back over the last, so how many years ago was it that you were at Berkeley, let's say?
That was
25. Whoa, wow. Now I'm feeling old.
So I've been programming professionally for 20 or 21 years now.
Yeah.
And I've been working professionally since.
Right. 20, 25 years, something like that. So if you look back over, I was just trying to get the number. If you look back over the 20, 25 years, what has brought you the most joy?
Travel.
Yeah. So not the work.
Like I honestly do love programming. I have like, I can't program at work because I'm answering questions. So I program at home because it gives me joy. And you know, the goal is I work on my own stuff at home until I find a project that I actually finish, and then hopefully makes me money. And then that will bring me money while I travel, but I will still, even while I travel, keep programming.
Got it. So a couple of things there I want to sort of talk about is the traveling piece of it, but it also sounds like you might have some entrepreneurial leanings, starting your own company or at least developing a product or something like that.
Yeah, I've done, and what, so with the entrepreneurial aspect, since it's closer to the past topic, I have had a number of online companies. At one point I had the only Daily Newton news site. So the Apple Newton PDA, back when the Palm Pilot and all that. Wow. So I wrote daily news about that, and I said, I could probably sell stuff related to this. So I also sold software and, you know, styluses and things related to the Newton, and that paid my income until Apple canceled the Newton, and then I just canceled the site. I'm like, well, this isn't going to go anywhere. So I like just stopped.
Okay.
Probably should have hung on a while there, because like there was still, people had them. They still needed software and stuff, and the market wasn't going to die immediately, but I just killed it and moved on. And I've sold t-shirts and CDs and all sorts of stuff online. I've definitely got the entrepreneurial streak.
Yeah.
The travel. So I was at Akamai. I was completely burnt out. And, one month I'm like, I gotta go. And they have, their vacation plan policy is, we don't have a specific number of weeks, work it out with your manager. And so I said, I need to go. I'm taking a month off. I'm going. And he's like, okay. Mm-hmm. And I got on my motorcycle, which was a kind of sports bike at the time, and set out for California. And I went to take Route 50, which is an old route that actually stretches the width of the United States. And I started going, and towards the end, I got a little stressed that I wasn't going to make it back in time. So I started coming back, had plenty of time. But by that point, it really opens my eyes to just like life on the road and travel. And then I came back, worked about another year, met Dakery, and who's now my wife. And I said, I'm going to the bottom of South America. Do you want to come? And she had bought my old motorcycle and fallen in love with motorcycle riding. She actually loves it more than me. And so we each got our motorcycles, and she'd gotten another one since then. And we set off together down, spent 4 months on the road. And we had a hard stop at 4 months because we had people house sitting and watching after the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an absolutely amazing trip.
Wow. How long ago was that?
That was started in December of 2010 and so ended early 2011.
Got it. What is it about travel, but specifically about motorcycle travel, that brings you so much joy, that just there's so much of a draw for you?
So for me, it's not as much motorcycle travel as travel. I don't like going, like, just flying into a destination. I like the in-between points. I like the land of a country and the people you meet along the way. Dakery absolutely loves motorcycles. I really, really enjoy riding on motorcycles, but I've found some downsides. So like the next trip will probably be in a covered vehicle, mm-hmm. but mostly it's life is much simpler on the road. And that's one of the big draws. You get up with the sun, you figure out where you're headed that day. You may or may not make it there.
Mm-hmm.
You travel, you discover people and things along the way. You don't know when you're going to eat. We had a rule that if it was even vaguely around a mealtime and you saw roadside food, you had to stop.
Yeah.
Because we found that was the food that is best eaten, the best food to eat. So, you know, some guy with a burning bucket and, you know, meat over it, you stop. And, every day we would spend, at the end of every day, we wrote up our travels and we treated it like a job. And Dakery probably knows how many words, but it's probably well over 100,000 words. Because literally every day we wrote, and it took us about 2 hours. And one day we would alternate. I would write and she would do the pictures and other related stuff. And the next day we'd switch. Mm-hmm. And so you got both of our perspectives as we rode. But we treated it as a job because we knew that if we put as much effort into it as we did, then the next trip, we would be able to look back at this. We would be able to point to this and say, hey, maybe you want to sponsor us. And given sponsorship on trips is hard to get and doesn't actually earn you money very much, but anything you can get helps. We're a little hampered by the fact that we have really high standards and we wouldn't actually want sponsorship from anyone who we didn't believe in the product.
Yeah.
And if we didn't, we wouldn't know if we believed in the product unless we already had it, which kind of defeats the point of sponsorship. And the sponsorship don't want to give you money anyways. They want to give you things. So we don't know, but you know, we've got that writing. It's bundled up in a book. We just have to finish editing. We've written another book about motorcycle riding and being safe, which we also haven't finished editing. It's just been sitting around, but.
It sounds like this is a book or a book in the making, but it's not published yet.
No.
Okay.
So there's one book, which is basically the diary entries of every day, each of us and what we encountered along the way. The other book is we are very committed to the idea of riding safely and the value of motorcycle gear. And we see a lot of people making very bad decisions primarily because they're uninformed. Mm-hmm. Like there are these people who wear the three-quarter helmets with no protection over their chin. And they probably wouldn't do that if they knew that 30% of the impacts when you hit are on the chin. It's like on the lower jaw. It's like just having a helmet with that chin. If you're going to be wearing a helmet anyways, maybe you want to reduce your risk by 30%, you know, if you're going down.
Just cover the whole face.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, and there's a ton of stuff like that. And I did, there's a couple reports about it that there've been two major studies been done about motorcycle safety and gear and what makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And I've read these and I know like, okay, this aspect of stuff works. And this one has no evidence backing up the theory. And, you know, and we've done a ton of research on the, like, what materials, you know, most motorcycle gear is made out of Cordura, which is a very good material. But as you go sliding down the road, it'll tend to melt into you. And then the doctors have to deal with ripping that out. And it's like, okay, what are your alternatives? Well, your alternatives, one of them is amazingly expensive, too expensive for most people. Yeah. And one of them has other deficiencies. And so, you know, we wrote something that was not preachy, but, you know, trying to go, hey, here are your alternatives. And it's going to be a very small book that someone can give to someone they care about and say, here, it's not going to be preachy. It's just like, here are your choices. Help you make an informed, like, at least if you're choosing badly, you will be choosing it with an informed decision, you know?
So, the dream for you, like the dream life that I'm assuming would involve some kind of travel, potentially on a motorcycle where you can go back to what it was like during those, during those 4 months.
I want to travel, sit down and do my work in the evenings, travel more the next day, you know, and just see the world. And we met so many amazing people and it made all these other places in the world, like you hear about Nicaragua and like growing up, Nicaragua was this, you know, massive ball of turmoil because of everything America did down there. But it's just this strange name in this foreign place. And now we've been there. We've met people there. We've been helped by people there. We've eaten with people there. Like Nicaragua is a real place to us. Like all the countries between here and there, we've been to the vast majority of them. And these are all real places. And you know, we got home and a volcano erupted in Chile and we're like, there were these videos of this town covered in ash and we're like, we were there 3 weeks ago.
Wow.
Like this isn't just a remote place. This is like, we were there, we ate there, we drove through there. And there's all this us versus them in the world. And one of the things that, you know, we learned so, so strongly is that, like, everyone is the same. And while politics and governments may do stupid things, the people you meet on the road, the everyday people of every country, are honestly good people wanting to help other people.
Yeah.
And it was a life-altering experience for us. And I want desperately to help open the eyes. And I know there's very little I can actually affect about this by, you know, writing our stories about these people, about our encounters in the world. Like I can't change much, but if I can show a few people that, like, you know, Mexico, like we even now have all this stuff about, oh, you go to Mexico, you'll get kidnapped and murdered. And it's like, no, you are far more likely to get kidnapped here in the US. Like you're much safer there. Like the people are amazing there. Like there's all this wonderful good stuff about Mexico and the media whips up this fear. And I want to show people like, no, these are good people. This is a wonderful place to visit. And most of the world is like that.
Yeah. So it sounds like traveling, especially to places where other people just wouldn't travel to because they'd be scared to, really would give you some perspective such that, you know, going back to your job, your regular sort of day job, the 9-to-5-ish, that if there's the quote unquote fires at work, that really gives you like, this is not a fire. That's a real fire. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So have you seen how have you sort of incorporated what you learned traveling and on the road to lessons for yourself at work and say lessons for your team at work?
So I think For me, the lessons that are applicable are probably not necessarily the ones my employer wants me to take and use, because they are that it doesn't matter. Like, we write software that ultimately helps people put things on shelves. Like, I don't care. I get that this is actually a piece of software that provides real value to the companies that use it, and it does save them millions of dollars a year. So, like, it does provide value to them.
Sure.
But this is just a tool for other people. And what the big thing that I try and impart to the juniors, especially that I work with, is that this is not your baby. Do not sacrifice yourself, your time, your friendships, your happiness to this company because they've got some stressy deadline. Mm-hmm. That's their business. If they're freaking out about that, that's not your problem. Like, you come in, you give me 40 hours a week, you do a good job, like, you put in real effort, you care. And, you know, when we ask a little more from you, you know, I expect you to give it. And I also expect that afterwards you will get a break. And I repeatedly, constantly tell my people, I don't want you working on the weekends. Why were you committing that stuff at night? Like, you mm-hmm. worked a full day, you know, and you worked a full day the next day. Stop, please mm-hmm. go have your life. I worked before the .com, crash, or actually during the .com crash. I was at this company and there was a developer there who like devoted himself to this company. Like, he just did, like, sometimes sleeping under the desk level of just, he loved coding, you know, and this happens with developers. You just get so into it, and he was just like, he worked and he worked and he worked, and he did not have an outside life. He did not have any friendship outside of the company. And then the .com crash came. They laid off a third of the workforce. They laid off another third of the workforce. They laid off the rest of the workforce.
Yeah.
And like, I keep thinking about him, and he's looking back, and 4 years of his life, he literally had nothing to show for it. He didn't work on any open source projects. He didn't develop friendships with people outside. So like, he had no software to show for it because the assets of the company got sold to IBM, I think. Mm-hmm. And he had no social things. Like, he could have been having fun with friends and building up relationships and falling in love and all these wonderful things you can do outside of work. And like, I don't want anyone I work with to ever be in that position, because like, it's fine if it's your company, you built this company, this is your baby. Like, I get that, like, go for it, because that is your baby. You're building this something that you care about. But most of us, it's like, no, I just come here because I need a paycheck. And also, like, I emphasize, like, and the reason that I stay where I am is because we have really good people.
Sure.
It's not because the software is fulfilling. Like, yeah. We put stuff on shelves. I don't care. That's about it. Sure. You know, and so I try to get people to care about themselves more than the company, because especially with software, we get so caught up with, oh, this deadline, and they need it by this. And it's like, you know what? Really, what happens if the deadline isn't met?
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it's a big deal to the company, and sometimes it is worth putting in more effort. But most of the time, like, you weren't even consulted about that deadline.
That's
and like,
right.
You're going to do it by next week. Dude, there's no way I can get that done by next week. We promised the client. Well, that's not my fault. You know,
like, exactly.
Don't make promises on my behalf.
Exactly.
That, you know, no. So yeah. I try and encourage them to.
You mentioned burnout earlier, that when you were working at Akamai, you mm-hmm. got to the point of burnout. And so my question to you is, how did you know? And the reason that I'm asking is because I think a lot of people may actually be burnt out, but not be aware of it, or maybe be on the cusp of being burnt out. And so I'm wondering what the experience was like for you, and to actually get to the point and label it as, yeah, I'm burnt out, I need to leave.
So it was, I got to a pretty extreme point. So everyone I worked with, like, on my team was good. I liked all the people I worked with. You mm-hmm. know, my manager was good. My teammates were good. you can argue whether or not the product we worked on was particularly good. But we were doing interesting work. So it wasn't a problem with that, but like, it was mostly like a constant low level stress, to like, and I'm sorry to swear on your podcast, but
that's okay. People have done it before.
I was literally saying when I left, that was like, fuck it. I don't care. Like, and it was literally that verbalizing like that in my head and verbally, like I could not take it anymore. I lost it. It's like, no, I cannot be here.
Yeah.
I have to leave. Mm-hmm. And for me, travel was the thing I chose, but mostly I think it was a form of, I need to get away. And I physically got away as far as I could. And I don't like, just airplanes aren't fun. I hate resorts. Like,
okay.
I do not like the idea of, oh, let's go somewhere and sit on the beach. Like, why?
Yeah.
Like, no, I need, motion is important to me and it is valuable to me. And like, I like the, because it is, I think it's important to me to be doing something. Mm-hmm. I have to be doing something,
mm-hmm.
and I have to be working towards something. And like that's somewhere where Dakari and I differ wildly, is that when she will go for a ride, I need to know where we're going. I don't actually care where we're going.
That's right.
I just have to have somewhere we are going to.
Yep.
Like the, and you know, on the bigger trip, it was like every morning we'd wake up, we'd look at the map and go, there, we're going there.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't matter if we made it there or not. We usually didn't, you know, or sometimes right. we'd go past it. But like, I had to have a destination we were headed for.
Yeah. I'm the same way. I think Rob and I are the same way. I can't just sit on the beach. Right. So we went to Bermuda. We sat on the beach for a little bit. I'm like, okay, when are we going snorkeling? All right, let's go snorkeling now. We'll go snorkeling for a half an hour. All right, then we come back and we're sitting on the beach again. Very comfortable, right? And we had the umbrella over us and everything. Okay, what are we going to do now? And he's looking at me like, what, can't we just sit here for a few minutes? No, all right, let me read my magazine. So I read my magazine for like 20 minutes. And like, what's next, right? Where am I going? And I'm the same way too. Like, as long as there's that destination, I can enjoy the journey as long as there's some destination there. Yeah, I could totally
and like,
relate to
I can...
that.
We, Dakari and I can both sit still and read in each other. And like, one of the great things about having the trip with, like that with someone you care about is that, I mean, it's a crucible for most relationships. It will either destroy or cement, like that type of trip will destroy or cement relationships. But one of the reasons that we succeed is we can be quiet in each other's presence. And when you're on a motorcycle, like separate motorcycles, we had the radios, so we were talking that over the headsets to each other, and we could say, oh hey, look at that. But most of the time we're within 20 yards of each other and not saying anything for the vast majority of the day, and just experiencing the world around us. Mm-hmm. And I think because we can do that with each other, we had someone to share the trip with. And I think that's an important thing to me, is having someone to share it with. And when we were writing, we were also sharing with, we had like, there were thousands of people following us online, because one thing we promised each other at the beginning was we won't just write the good parts. Cause a lot of the motorcycle travels, you get macho guys writing about the badass thing they've done. I rode up this volcano.
Yeah.
I did this huge thing. I was in a terrible thing and straight, and I manly got out of it. And we're like, no, we will write the truth. We want to write because we wanted the story that we wished was out there for us. We wanted to see, like, how do other people deal when like, it's not fun? How do you deal when it's too hard? You know, at one point, like Dakari, we were doing something that was too hard for her and she broke down on the side of the road crying.
Yeah.
And we wrote about that. And we, you know, we shared that with people. And because of that honesty that we put out there, there were a number of women who wrote to us later, because Dacre had been writing for 6 months before she took this trip on. Yeah. And there are these women who wrote to us and were like, you know, thank you for this. Because of what Dacre shared, I went on a trip with my husband. I went on a trip by myself. I went and did this. And we had all these beginning people who had been saying, like, making up all these excuses for why they couldn't go on this trip. And some of them were beginners and some of them were people who'd been, oh, I would someday. And like, oh, I can't because I don't have this big motorcycle, or I don't have an experience with that, or I don't have this. And we showed them, like, listen, just go and enjoy the life out there. And it gave us so much pleasure to hear from these people that said, like, hey, I went on a trip because of what you wrote. Mm-hmm. And like, they went and enjoyed the world and learned more about the people around them. And that was amazing.
Yeah. So when's the next trip?
Very, very soon.
Do you have a specific date for it, or are you just sort of?
No, Dacre and I are kind of figuring out what our plans are of, you know, because she's working on her writing publishing empire, and I just want to travel right now, but she needs more time per day for the starting a whole new empire business. Publishing is an amazing amount of work, we're discovering, and so.
Yeah.
She wants to focus on that because writing is her passion, and I want to focus on the travel. So we might split up for a little while and then come back or something. We'll figure it out. But
Got it. So you're sort of, you're doing the dance for now until you're back in sync again.
Yep.
Got it. Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant hand-holding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. So the very last question I'm going to ask you, Kay, is the question that I ask everyone in the podcast. So thinking about people, you know, you've talked about people a lot, that it's not that you like what you do at Wendor, but it's mostly because of the people. And then when you travel, it's about meeting the people and meeting all the wonderful different kinds of people in the world. So thinking of that, people can be challenging as well, though. Dealing with people can be challenging. So when you think of your job, but I'm going to expand it a little bit more, given that our conversation sort of went outside of the work realm to more of the life realm as well. But what's the biggest people-related challenge that you've ever had to deal with, whether it was at work or whether it was just in life in general? Biggest people-related challenge.
The biggest one is probably not something I'm comfortable sharing on a podcast.
That's fine.
I don't really know. Like, people are frustrating, you know, and I think that can be doubly so amongst engineers, because there's so much Asperger-y stuff going on that you've got the social interaction problems with people, and you also have that something that happens at every software company I've ever encountered or heard of is that no matter what you're doing, the clients either want something stupid or do something stupid. And, you know, whether or not that's an accurate perception, it still is the perception and frequently the belief, and sometimes it's right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how do you deal with the, like, this is the wrong thing to do, but I have to do it. Or, you know, for me, it's just accepting that. And with people, it's kind of the same thing, accepting that people are going to either do things that you disagree with strongly, and in some cases, it's just accept it and move on and let them, like learning to not internalize their stuff. And in some cases, it's trying to encourage them to modify either their behavior or how they approach things or their actions, or make them cognizant of the consequences of it. That, you know, just because you have a strongly held belief doesn't mean it is necessarily appropriate and not impactful to loudly espouse that belief. It's like, yeah, okay, I got that you have that, but maybe think about the people around you when you say it. Think about what the impacts to other people are, and you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah, it could be hard to choose your battles, I guess, that what stuff. So when people are frustrating, right, do you just choose to let it be and you let it go in one ear and out the other and just say, that's them, okay, and you accept it, I can't change it, versus the situation where you might be able to change it and you really want to get through to someone, like, oh, there's actually a different way of looking at it, or I've tried it this way and it worked this way too, and not just your way, but when do you do that, right? When do you clash with someone?
And then there's so there's definitely exactly what you said, but there's also sometimes where I will intentionally take on that clash, hopefully not in a dramatic clashy way, knowing full well that I will not succeed, but not doing it for the person I'm clashing with, doing it for the people nearby. I will never convince this person, but I want the people around, people hearing the argument, to hear a counter argument, to hear alternatives, because I may not affect the person with a strong opinion, but I might affect some of the people around us.
Yeah. And I think that's a great way of dealing with the loudest voice gets his or her way phenomenon, right? The loudest voice in the meeting is the one that's usually heard and is acted upon. That if you can just, you acknowledge it, you say, hey, that's a great point, I understand, but what about this counterpoint?
Yeah.
And especially if there's other people in the room as well, decision makers in the room too, that can be a really nice way of artfully making sure that other opinions are heard as well and not just the loudest one.
And the other related aspect is that because I've been doing this for 20 years, because I have been dealing with the clients directly, because I have been the person who came in and fixed the spaghetti code, you know, like, this is a horrible mess, we need someone to help us out, and it's got to be done by the end of the month, I've been the person like digging through the trash, like, I've seen a lot of aspects of this business and a lot of sides to it that especially the juniors haven't seen. And even the people who've been doing it for longer, but who have been just, you know, safely ensconced in the engineering department and not been on these, you know, they've been in more mature teams, they haven't been dealing with clients, so they haven't, like, I know what it's like to be the person who comes in after your bad code. So I'm going to tell you, like, listen, there's a huge value in leaving that helpful comment for someone. There's a huge value in making sure that this is readable. And like, I'll frequently tell people, I will take a longer, less elegant, but simpler method that maybe does it in a cruder, if performance isn't hurting us, I will take this simpler thing that I can look at and read and understand easily, and the person after me can, over a faster, more efficient, cooler thing any day of the week, because I've been the person coming afterwards. And because I've been with the clients, like, I know, like, some of these things seem like crazy requests when they get to the engineering department, but they're real, like, there are real human or strange use cases that us in engineering not using the product don't really understand. And it's like, the people who do interface with the product, with the clients, like, they talk to them. They try, you know, I trust that they are actually trying to understand the clients. And I may not understand why they've asked this to me, And sometimes I will talk to them about it. And sometimes I'll accept that, like, I happen to know that they talk to the client. I don't know why they need this crazy thing. Mm-hmm. It may not make any sense to me, but we have to trust that our coworkers know what they're doing. We have to trust that there is value in, you know, them doing their job well, because, you know, we talk to them, they seem to be good people. They, you know, when I talk to them about what they do, they seem to know what they're doing. You know, I don't do their job with them, so I can't say definitively, but, you know, I got to believe in the other people. And
yeah,
part of that comes from the travel too, because it's like, you depend on other people. Your vehicle breaks down in the middle of nowhere, you know, sometimes you need help. Like, sometimes you get lost in the mountains and you need someone to lead you out. And, you know, I got to trust in the basic goodness of other people and that people will try and do the best they can.
The lost in the mountains metaphor is great, but I take it that using that example that you may have literally gotten lost in the mountains before.
Yeah.
And right, so you know what it's literally like, but I think that metaphor extends to leading a team, that we're really lost here and we need to trust that other people will come help us and that what the advice that they're giving us is the right advice and will get us where we need to go.
Yeah.
Awesome. So on that note, how about we wrap it up?
All right.
It was great talking with you, Kay, and I look forward to hearing about all your future travels wherever they may take you.
People can read about them at corporaterunaways.com.
Say it once more.
Corporaterunaways.com.
All right. You heard it here, folks. Check it out. Hear all about Kay's travels and where they will take him. Thank you very much.
Bye.